of 12:45 having arrived, I'm going to call to order the Greater Minnesota Jobs and Economic Development Finance Division. I'm going to make a motion that House File 3633 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. That'll bring the bill before us. We have a list of testifiers, members. We have one that will be added, so we have four. With that, Director Kelly, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about the Disaster Assistance Contingency Account. For the record, my name is Joe Kelly. I'm the Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management with the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. Mr. Chair, I would intend to provide some basic background on the contingency account, give you a quick update as to its current status, and then provide just a very quick introduction, rationale, if you will, for the governor's recommendation for a general fund transfer. The Disaster Assistance Contingency Account was established in 2014. Its creation was rooted in a 2012 evaluation report that was written by the Office of the Legislative Auditor entitled Helping Communities Recover from Natural Disasters. Among the key actions that the legislature took following that report were, number one, was a commitment to paying the entire non-federal share, the 25%, for a FEMA disaster declaration, creating a framework to provide state disaster assistance when an event was not of the severity and magnitude to get help from the federal government, and third, creating a standing account to pay for those expenses. The disaster contingency account provides financial relief to communities by helping fund the costs of repairing uninsured damage to public infrastructure and other extraordinary costs of responding. Eligible expenses range from removing storm debris from streets to restoring a rural electric power cooperative service to fixing local roads and bridges that are damaged by floodwaters. By law, the account funds the entire 25% non-federal share for presidential disaster declarations and 75% for gubernatorially declared disasters when federal aid is not available. The contingency account has helped Minnesota communities recover from major events that triggered 5 federal declarations and 40 state declaration since 2014. Mr. Chair and members, the account has worked exactly the way the legislature intended it since its creation, and the governor has not had to call the legislature into special session to provide disaster relief since we've had this account. It is viewed as a state level best practice, and most of my colleagues across the country wish they had a similar program to help their local communities recover from disasters. The last 2 years have been exceptionally active for natural disasters in Minnesota. We have received 3 federal declarations for rain-triggered flooding during the spring and summer of 2018. We had an inland hurricane in Duluth that same fall that did significant damage to the shoreline and waterfront facilities. And then, of course, we all remember that not even a year ago, we had some terrible spring weather that had flooding and an ice storm and all kinds of other calamities in the middle of it. 2018 and 19 also saw the governors from 2 administrations authorize state disaster assistance, again, absent federal aid, 16 times for a wide variety of events ranging from flash flooding, severe thunderstorms, and a tornado outbreak. You see at the bottom there, just in the last 2 years alone, there have been 1,400 local applicants for disaster assistance that is funded through this account. Those are city, township, county, and tribal government agencies and activities that have paid for the damage done by natural disasters and are then seeking reimbursement for that as financial relief. That's a lot of activity in the last 2 years. And I can assure you that the resources the legislature has put in this contingency account are being well used They are deeply appreciated by local governments, and quite frankly, they are counted on when disaster strikes. Mr. Chair and members, here's a real quick accounting of the fund since it was created. You have appropriated and transferred $82 million into the account. We have transferred $76 million out to provide assistance to our local communities recovering from the effects of disaster. That makes it sound like we got about a $6 million balance. Unfortunately, we now know that is not true, because last month FEMA informed us that the costs associated with last spring's flooding were going to go from $40 million that was projected to now $76 million. So that's a $36 million increase. And we pay, the state pays 25% of that. Doing math, that says that's $9 million. And that's why we have a $3 million deficiency in the account that we project currently. Mr. Chair and members, the governor is recommending a $30 million transfer from the general fund to the contingency account early in the session so that we can cover that deficiency and then know that the money is in hand for what I think everyone anticipates will be major spring flooding. We anticipate it'll be to the level where FEMA will help the state, but right now the odds are stacked against us and that we're going to probably see significant spring flooding. And then on average, over the past few years, you know, we have between $7 and $10 million a year for state disasters. Those things are where events are bad enough to hurt local communities and impact them financially, but for which there is no federal aid. And I imagine, Mr. Chair and members, I will be sitting here next year again explaining what we think, trying to forecast what the budget requirements for the coming biennial budget will be. Mr. Chair, that concludes my prepared remarks. I stand for your questions.
Director Kelly, I want to thank you and explain to members of the committee. We have had this discussion ongoing since October 2nd through 4th when the mini session was held in southeastern Minnesota. This committee and Representative Wagenius' committee had a hearing at My Energy in Rushford. Director Kelly was there, and at that time we were even discussing whether or not there would be a $20 million transfer because of the way the special session had set up the transfer into this account. I don't think I need to remind this committee that there is nothing special about a special session. And the rather convoluted way that they had put money into this account is not the way that House File 3633 is putting money into the account. This is a straight-up appropriation. It is not coming because of a contingency. So I'm going to do a little definition. This is a contingency account. It is a contingency account that is contingent on whether or not the President of the United States or the governor of this state declares a disaster. It is not a contingency account that exists whether or not there is money in it. And those are two different types of accounts. This account was created under the contingency that if the President of the United States or the governor of this state declares a disaster, then this account is used just as Director Kelly had directed it. I think our friends in the Senate are a bit confused, and we would hope this legislative session to straighten them out. So I also want to talk just a little bit about the mini session. To my left and to my right, Ms. Schaffel and Mr. Wirth, these are the two staff people that carried 99.9% of all of the work to organize that mini session. This was no small endeavor. You're going to see another individual up here soon who participated in the organization. So I'm going to explain, too. The last week of July and into the mini session, there were five meetings at Winona State, with as many as 35 to 45 people in attendance every 2 weeks at those meetings. So we had local units of government. We had K-12. We had higher ed. We had Project Find. We had anyone who had an interest in explaining to us where they would like the Minnesota House and its committees to go and what they should be hearing. So this mini session was literally built from the ground up, and these two were the ones that were coordinating by text, email, phone, and some very interesting conversations I was copied on as to what we would be doing over those 3 days. So we may be having a hearing just to describe the particulars of that mini session and the hope that we will do more of them. So with that, if anyone has any questions to Director Kelly, Representative Anderson, although it doesn't show it, he is a co-sponsor on this bill, and I thank Representative Anderson for doing that. It'll show up, I think, today when we go into session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Kelly, I want to thank you also for the great work you do with the state here in this area. A couple of questions. First of all, for FEMA going from 40 to 76, that's a big jump. Was that 40 just a drive-by guess, or how could they increase their estimate by that much in 1 year?
Director Kelly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, that estimate was based on what we call a preliminary damage assessment. So in the immediate aftermath of the flooding and then the ice storm, we invited FEMA to come to town. We said, it appears that we are going to have an event that qualifies for federal assistance, but as they always do, you need to come, and because it is their assessment, and verify at least the going-in number for the damage that our local governments have identified. And at the end of that assessment, which quite frankly, we wanted 3 weeks to visit 51 counties and 4 tribal nations all around the state, they were only able to give us 2 weeks. And $40 million was the number. It was more than enough to qualify for federal disaster assistance. So that was kind of like when the insurance adjuster comes to your house and gives you an estimate about, you know, how much damage is to your roof or whether you need new siding. And now we're at the part of that process where we're actually doing project worksheets. We're looking at bills that local communities have accumulated as they repair their roads, they repair the power system, they pay those other costs, and the actual costs are coming in much higher. It's always kind of a tricky proposition because it is a preliminary estimate. But frankly, it's a little extraordinary that it's off by almost 100%. Now, the good news is that when the president issued that declaration, FEMA regional administrator out of Chicago and Governor Walz signed what we call a FEMA state agreement. And FEMA said they would reimburse our local communities they would reimburse them 75% of their eligible expenses. There was no cap on it. So if it goes to $100 million, FEMA will reimburse those communities. That's the good news, because those are bills that are being borne by cities and townships and tribal governments. On the other hand, what makes it uncomfortable for us and for others is that we count on that number to do our budgeting. And when the number is off that much, we are suddenly in the position where I have to go to my commissioner, who then has to go to the administration and say, we're going to need more money in order to fulfill our obligations under this disaster. I hope that answers your question.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. On a slightly different topic, back home in my area, some areas received some benefits and some didn't. And then our local townships got together for their, I think, spring meeting, and there got to be some discussion as to why some townships got aid, some didn't. And the thing that I recall is that frost boils last year were covered, and we've had frost boils in our township roads for years, and you just took care of them yourselves. But last year they were covered under this disaster declaration. So did the word not get out, or how did some arrive at getting aid for things like frost boils and some didn't know about it? And did that change as the spring season went along?
Director Kelly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I know more about frost boils than I thought I would ever know at this stage of my life. Typically, you are correct. Frost boils are not considered disaster damage because that's part of the circle of the seasons in Minnesota when the frost comes out of the ground. But when they are combined with widespread overland flooding, the damage, it's very hard to, you can't separate that necessarily identify the damage between the frost boils, the flooding, the overtopping of roads, and so forth. So categorically, if you had a road in your township or in your county that were damaged by the flooding, FEMA for this instance was not going to make a distinction between frost boils, because it basically was the same stretch of road. Some of the damage could be attributed to the frost coming out of the ground. Some of it could be because of the flooding. They said this is all one event. Regarding the word getting out, we rely on the county emergency managers and the county boards of commissioners to let folks know that FEMA is coming to town and we need their help doing that damage assessment, as well as once we get a declaration, townships have to come to a meeting to get a briefing on their responsibilities and the process to be an applicant and to get reimbursed.
Representative Anderson, your point's well taken, your first point about how this works. When we had the 2007 disaster and subsequently the disaster in Duluth, when you call a special session right after a disaster, you're guessing at how much you should put in and where you should put it. Chapters 12A and then subsequently Chapter 12B stop the guessing. There's a protocol put in place, and we've been refining it since 2014 in order to say that we know what is applicable, and then we can get the help to those areas as fast as we can. And as Director Kelly said, the local units of government now should have the experience of how to apply, what to apply for, and what to expect. And that's why this was set up. Members, further questions? Representative Salt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. After that discussion, I'm going to modify the question that I gave you earlier, but it's going to be in that same vein. There is huge economic drain on the local economy when this kind of a disaster comes through. This is analogous to the argument that was presented to us when they built the football stadium. They were parading around and saying how much positive economic impact was going to be realized from that thing being here and or events that would follow. The opposite is actually very true and oftentimes more devastating than we realize, and I'm trying to gather from the fact that we have available to us a statistical catalog, if you will, that we should now be able to look at and have some sense for economic purposes, both for local government planning and for just impact planning, is what kind of economic impact is realized with one of these kinds of disasters. I'm sure there is a factor that we could come up with. Most economists are very good at figuring out the relationship of end result of a certain set of conditions that would build an economic impact. And for a lot of the small governments, whether it would be counties and particularly counties and townships, I guess, because they have oftentimes they're the stewards of the physical in terms of the assets, for them to be able to look at and look forward as to how are these impacts going to be realized to us and what is the kind of the economic vectors that we should be aware of. County commissioners do think about that sort of thing. When they're sitting there making their budgets, they're thinking about what are risks that we have to be aware of? How are these risks going to be realized and how do they grow? So my sense is you have no chance of knowing or being able to answer that question directly, because I don't think you probably sit around trying to analyze that. But I think that if you could go back and get some economists to do the numbers and the analysis of how does an impact of X million in dollars then grow into an economic draw and economic pull on a local economy. Because the fact is that these economies run because they have all of these assets, and those economies generate wealth and generate cash flow in that area. Well, the opposite is true when you go through one of these disasters. The normal economy, the cash flow of that economy, has a drain in it that's oftentimes unimaginable. And they basically come out at the other end wondering for sure if they're going to be able to go forward. So I'll lay that out there. I suspect I know what the answer might be. But
Director Kelly.
Mr. Chair and Representative, thank you for giving me the out, by the way. But it's actually a serious question. Partly back to Representative Anderson's question about do people know what to do when these things happen. You know, we have endeavored to create an elected officials training program for counties, townships, and city elected officials. And one of the things that when I go out and try to put this in context, we talk about how I ask how many of you have a disaster reserve in your township budget? You know, how much money do you have set aside for disasters? Even at the county level, the answer is none. So all of the budgets that I have run into, the people I've talked to, these are blue sky budgets. When you look at some of the damage being done, you have a township that has a $100,000 a year annual budget, and most of that goes to road maintenance and repair, and just road maintenance, dealing with frost boils and respreading gravel and grading. And when they have $750,000 of expenses from a storm, they don't have the ability to pay for that. So the negative economic impact of either having to leave those roads unrepaired, and in greater Minnesota, these are the roads that farmers take their crops to market on. It's how our children get to school. It's how emergency services get to residents. You look at the economic impact of, one, not doing their repair, or two, assuming the cost of that, it would be tremendous. They are actually, as we said in remarks and as the chair mentioned, these local units of government are counting on this disaster assistance being there for them, so they don't have to suffer those negative economic consequences of having to pay for damage that's simply not in the budget and maybe not even in their capacity to raise those funds. But I will endeavor to try to find an answer to the impact of the negative impact, if you will, the economic costs associated with natural disasters.
Thank you.
Representative Salk, before you do that, I see Representative Juergens is here. He's also a co-sponsor. Why don't you come down and join the committee? You don't need to sit way back there. Come on down. You're welcome. He's a sponsor of the bill, too. So, Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other thing, and again, this is expressing my curiosity in this particular realm. One of the things that has arisen for us, I think it's very, very close at hand, very close at sight for us, is that we've gone through very unimaginable economic challenges to our agricultural industry. And we as a state have, last year particularly, responded to the emotional and societal pressure of that kind of stress, the cash flow stress, the negative aspects of having an operation that you're not realizing what it is you planned and how you work at it. There's bills been passed to try to deal with that issue of the emotional impact. That is also real in these kinds of circumstances. Whole communities will have realized or had an emotional impact that I'll bet anything FEMA never writes out a check saying, here, we need to get you the resources from six hospitals so that we can address the emotional needs of your community while you're crawling out of all the mud and muck that just arrived. So that's another point of what it is as a state. We would be better if we actually said there are quantifiable negatives that one should be at least resourcing and or somehow planning for.
Director Kelly.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the community trauma that you're referring to is indeed real. If an event is big enough and bad enough, sometimes FEMA does provide some assistance with what we call behavioral health. And that is to provide support, counseling, and other systems in the local community to help people get through this, those kind of events, because there is no doubt that those effects are real, just as they are within the agriculture community for agricultural disasters. It's an area that is much fuzzier, softer than damage to a bridge or a road or a water treatment plant, but it's still there, and it's some of what's authorized under long-term recovery in Chapter 12A, which is one of the things that came out of the 2007 Rushford floods, is to recognize those requirements.
Director Kelly, I prepped you in advance, so you know it's coming. What if we would have a disaster the size of the 2007 southeastern Minnesota disaster, which, by the way, happened, we were not in session? What would the amount have to be in this account in order to begin the process of addressing all of the things we've talked about so far as fast as possible?
Mr. Chair and members, if we go back to the appropriations made in 2007 for that event, for damage to public infrastructure only, so not getting at some of the other things, the community needs that we're talking about, And we update them the $2020 for that event alone. It's in the neighborhood of $40 million that would have to be appropriated for public infrastructure alone. And that's without regard to any other disasters or regard to anything that might be happening within the state's disaster assistance program.
And Director Kelly, how long did we delay in calling a special session in 2007? Do you remember?
Mr. Chair, I do not know the answer to that question. I was in the Army and wasn't paying attention.
I do. It was several weeks. Mm-hmm. So when you're delaying several weeks, you're now putting people in harm's way. And you're also increasing your costs, which is, I think, Representative Salk's point. And where we were also, because the event happened in August, we didn't have the special session didn't happen until September. We were also then looking at winter, and winter compounds all of this in unimaginable ways. So, again, these two chapters of law were created so we would never again be put in that situation where a community literally had to beg for a special session. No, when people are hurt, then it's our responsibility to help, or areas of the state are hurt. Members, any more questions of Director Kelly? He's going to stick around just in case anyone else gets stuck, including the chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Next up, Brian Crambier. He's going to have a presentation. This is the presentation that we saw in Rushford at My Energy. Now, Mr. Crambier, I should say President Crambier, My Energy was one of the entities that participated in the planning of the mini session. So for those five sessions that were held every 2 weeks, we had a representative from My Energy. We used My Energy and its state-of-the-art facility to not only take a look at disaster aid, but also how an electric co-op works in the 21st century. So I want to thank President Crambier for his help in planning the mini-session and then for offering us his facility for the hearings that we had the second day of the mini-session in southeastern Minnesota. So would you welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chairman Pawlowski, members of the committee. My name is Brian Crambier, President and CEO of My Energy Cooperative, which is headquartered in Rushford, Minnesota. And thank you for the opportunity to be able to testify today about our experiences and going through a disaster with the 2007 and flood. On August 17th and 18th, over 17 inches of rain fell in southeastern Minnesota. And it pretty much devastated the community of Rushford. This is a picture from the top of the bluff that shows you the community. This picture right here is a little closer up, and the building up in the right-hand corner with the brown roof is our headquarters facility. It had a full basement, but it also had 4 feet of water on the main level. The white building behind it was our warehouse facility that we kept all of our material and all of our vehicles for restoring electric service. We lost 26 vehicles, all of our Digger Derrick trucks, our entire fleet was underwater in our warehouse. This was the basement of our office. We lost all of our record keeping and documents. We are a borrower of the Rural Utility Services under the old REA program. Again, all of our historical records and documentation were totally destroyed. This was our downstairs training room that was totally submerged. We experienced $6.5 million in co-op damage. Our office, our warehouse, our building contents. We lost our entire fleet of vehicles, our inventory. In addition to that, we also had substantial damage to our electric distribution line that we provide electric service to in southeastern Minnesota. We were very fortunate to receive FEMA assistance. FEMA did approve what's called an improved project of $1.3 million for us relocating west of town to help us build our new headquarters facility. And with that, our building was still structurally sound. And we sold that to Norseland LEFSA. Hopefully, maybe some of you have heard of that organization. I know Representative Poppy has. And they have also done their share, if I could get this to operate, have done their share to to support? I guess the video didn't run there. That's okay. Southeastern Minnesota, they did a lottery video that you'll have to Google also, talking about LEFSA and lottery tickets from Minnesota. The damages that we had for our FEMA application totaled $4.6 million. It was an 18-month process of providing receipts for expenses, and we obtained $3.5 million of that, 75% of the total. Thankfully, we received $2.3 million from the state of Minnesota. That alone helped us with our fleet replacement, which we had an expense over $2 million after insurance coverage. That covered a portion of the 25% that FEMA did not. It came in the form of a 90% forgivable loan, being able to retain that $2.1 million. The groundbreaking ceremony for our facility that I described with the improved project west of town occurred in November 2007, and we were able to move forward and move into our new headquarters facility in September 29, 2008. Because of the assistance that we received, we not only are a strong and viable organization, we have also merged with our neighboring electric co-op, Hawkeye REC in Iowa, and that is why you hear, see the name My Energy Cooperative, which was formerly Tri-County Electric. My purpose here today is to thank the legislators for providing the critical dollars, truly to help us get back on our feet. I also want to recognize Representative Chair Pawlowski for his legislative work on this disaster program. When this disaster hit in 2007, there was a gray area of electric co-ops, telephone co-ops, any nonprofit, if they were eligible for state assistance. That has been clarified. But the other challenge that we had in 2007 was we were waiting for the governor to declare a special session for us to be able to even act on these damages. So in summary, you've done great work. A lot of reform has went in place to make this a very strong program. Now we no longer have to wait for a governor to call a special session. We no longer have the issues of what is covered and who is covered in a disaster. And I would also like to recognize Mr. Kelly's staff and their department. In my dealings with them, they do an outstanding job during very difficult times. So I would also like to stress the comments made from one of your committee members. Timing of the relief funds is so very critical when this disaster occurs, and providing that support and that hope to a community means a lot to be able to move forward. So I certainly would speak in support of making sure you have the financial resources to help a community if they ever experience some type of a disaster. So that concludes my comments, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you.
Members, when the special session was finally called and we had a bill before the legislature, and I know I gave this presentation in January of last year, but I'll remind you, I was the one that was responsible in the House to carry the bill. I asked, when we had staff in my office prior to 9 o'clock in the morning when we were going down for our first hearing, where the bill came from. And even House research really didn't know. So we figured it out later that what the governor had done and his staff had taken every disaster over the previous 50 years, cobbled together a bill, and that was our bill to address this disaster. So fires, tornadoes, locusts, plague, I don't know what else was thrown into this thing. And we had to somehow figure out how to address what is still the largest disaster in the history of the state. I will say one thing. After every hearing, I know who I had a phone call from. I had a phone call from Brian Cranbier clarifying things for me that came up in committee and then from other areas of Rushford. So that is not the way to address a disaster. And subsequently, when we put the bill into effect after the governor signed it, I had repeatedly used in committee flexibility because we had put amounts of money into different areas, and we really didn't know if that was the amount. So there was a clause built into the final bill that if you spent over what you had and someone was spending less, we could shift those dollars over. Again, that's not the way to spend state money. So we learned a hard lesson in 2007. But without the help of Rushford, and I will say Rushford is not in my district. This is in Representative David's district. So you also have to help your neighbors out on occasion. Was there a question over here? No, I thought I saw someone. So yeah, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Krembeer, thanks for being here. Just a clarification, when you were waiting during that 2007 disaster for the state disaster declaration and in the state machinery to work, did that also hold up the FEMA money, or could you access before the state produced its declaration?
Mr. Krembeer.
Chairman Pawlowski, Representative Anderson. We were proceeding in the process of cleaning up under FEMA of our current facilities and putting projects together to go through that assistance progress. So we were able to move to an extent possible. But I think the biggest thing that was overshadowing us is what was the financial impact and what was the recovery that the co-op and its members were going to have to sustain.
Further questions, members? None? Thank you again.
Thank you for the opportunity, Representative Pawlowski, Chairman, and members of the committee.
Next on the list is, I think, a familiar name, Kate Knuth. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Kate Knuth, and I am currently a climate policy advisor with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and I really appreciate you taking a few minutes to hear from me today. I have a handout. I apologize I didn't get this to the committee earlier. I was, give that to you. First of all, I'm here today to testify in strong support of House File 3633 and funding the disaster contingency account in general. At MCEA, we have a decades-long track record of using law and science to help protect the health of people and the environment here in Minnesota. And we are increasingly concerned about the increased number and severity of disasters in our state due to climate change. And we're supportive of proactively investing in disaster readiness to make sure that the Disaster Contingency Fund is fully funded to help Minnesotans when they need it most, as the committee has already talked about, when as soon after a disaster strikes their homes and communities as possible. Climate change is already driving increases in weather conditions that create disasters in our state. We've seen a 65% increase in the number of 3-inch rainfalls in the past 100 years in Minnesota. And as you know, 3-inch rainfalls in 24 hours makes a pretty significant impact in a community. And part of the challenge of these rain events is rain is falling on increasingly saturated ground. 10 of the warmest and wettest years in Minnesota on record have all happened since 1998. These are exactly the kinds of trends we would expect in extreme weather, given what we know about climate change. Warmer air holds more moisture, which means more rainfall, and this rainfall comes in bigger events like the ones experienced in Rushford in 2007 and in Duluth in 2012. It's important to note that the data we're talking about with these trends is not projection data. It's data that we've already seen happening in the state, and projections going forward mean are expected to get worse. But we all know these disasters, they go beyond statistics. Whole communities and the state that supports them feel these disasters in very real and personal ways. In 2007, in the community of Rochester and further in southeastern Minnesota, the floods in Duluth in 2002, there's people who are still recovering from these, both emotionally and economically. And we share the concern of many Minnesotans in knowing that the wet soils this spring, from last fall going into this spring, are creating the potential for severe spring flooding. So Minnesota communities will only increasingly go through the challenge and trauma of climate change-driven disasters. And as a state, we owe it to Minnesotans to make sure they have the resources they need to recover. We support the state prioritizing disaster relief and recovery. That's essential for the resilience of all our communities in the face of a changing climate. That's why we're here today, to support House File 3633. We're very grateful, Chair Pawlowski, for your leadership on disaster preparedness, not this year, but in a decade or more than a decade of making sure our state has the tools to respond in the ways it needs. We ask that in the months and years to come, that this committee looks more deeply at the increasing disaster risk Minnesota faces as it grapples with how to deal with climate change and resilience in the face of climate change. I've looked, quite frankly, for data on and how to measure the costs on communities, both preventative infrastructure investment and disaster recovery, and I have not yet found good numbers to help us understand the extent of how much climate risk and the increasing risks our communities face because of climate change will cost us as a state in years to come. And so we are ready and willing to partner with you on this work, but we see this as a really important down payment on disaster preparedness and readiness in the face of more increased risk from climate change, and we hope to see this kind of work continue and get better into the future. Happy to stand for any questions.
Questions, members? Representative Salk, you're pondering something there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have no clue whether you can answer this.
I'm happy to try.
Yes.
Representative.
So is there a way of showing, because we have wonderful mapping abilities now.
Yep.
Part of it is from Weather Forecasting World, and some of it is from the geology. Do we have a way of understanding the capacity of certain lands or configurations of Earth as to its ability to first absorb, second control or manage runoff and the flow of water across its landscape? Do we have ways to know that, and or is that do you have some magic colored map that I could look at that would show me this is the way it looks?
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The title stays with you as long as you're alive. So
I can say doctor now, too. That one was harder earned. thank you, Representative, for the question. I don't have those specific answers in terms of a map at my fingertips. The University of Minnesota has a great resource in this area. There's a group called the Natural Capital Project, and they are a collaboration involving the U. Professor Steve Pulaski, who's in the Applied Economics Department there, is very closely involved. And they try to understand and map how natural ecosystems provide services for us, flood control being and water quality being a really important one. And they've done quite a bit of work here in Minnesota because they are partially based here in Minnesota. So that would be one resource. I'd be happy to send you some information about that group and how they might be able to answer some questions about Minnesota. That's helpful. I mean, soil matters. The quality of the soil, the health of the soil matters in terms of how it handles rainfall from climate change or from extreme weather events driven by climate change.
Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm struck by how inadequately I can guess how water will flow and what will cause it to do that. I've lived in two areas that flooded. One was down in central Iowa, where they had an 8-inch rain overnight. I heard the rain coming down, got up, and there was water all the way around our house. And it was a bit of a surprise to my father-in-law, who was sleeping in the basement, who swung his feet out of the bed and all of a sudden let out a yelp. And that was my warning that we had water in our basement. The reason that I kind of do it is because those are the frames of how we in real life experience these things. We wake up someday and all of a sudden the road is gone. That sort of thing today with our computerized modeling of river flows, water flows, and the impact of rainwater, we can now kind of generate an understanding of the life that we may have if we just ignore these things. And I guess that's, to me, the most useful thing for us, because we're sitting here having to make good decisions, good planning decisions as to allocation of resources and that sort of thing, based on what we think we know. Well, it's no secret to any of you. I'm old, but I still cannot predict what the rain event will look like when you run water through Rochester, which is, by the way, this gigantic valley. Most people don't realize that Rochester sits at the bottom of a big valley, and a lot of water wants to go through that valley, and it doesn't always. So the last time we did, we had to restrict all that water. A long story that knowledge and planning, having experienced that, changed what we do with our water runoff in our area. And I would say that that's generally true. Austin's got challenges that they can't fix like we can, because that's mostly flat land over there, and that's much harder to change. Similarly, out in the western part of the state, flat land water run is very difficult to control. So these are things that I think we have the ability, we have the toys to be able to model this stuff, and we should be. And I don't necessarily hear that coming.
Representative Knuth, you don't necessarily need to respond.
Yeah.
We have another member who's got a question
Great.
For you. Though. Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation. Do you have any data about mega rains since 2014 to the present?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. The chart, it's the best one we could find. There's been a couple more in 2016. If I am remembering my website right, the Environmental Quality Board has some great information in their energy and environment report card that came out last year. And just if the committee is interested, if you're interested in understanding in some of these weather trends, the DNR actually has a really fantastic mapping tool looking at historic data on weather and weather events, rains, heat, cold, and you can map it in different ways, and it's an interactive tool, and they're actually working on putting projections, like downscale data projections, to understand what kind of climate impacts we expect going forward. So there's another great resource, and I kind of pulled this together with some colleagues quite quickly, so we didn't have it further than 2014. So my apologies, we don't have the last few years, but the trend's pretty clear in that chart.
Representative Sandstead.
Mr. Chair, thank you. If you would be able to get some of that updated information to me, I would be most appreciative. And then following up on Representative Sauk's comments, questions, if we don't have the tool in place right now to look at the state in its entirety as how different locations will respond to certain weather events, is there a tool that exists for a particular area that you could plug in and say, okay, for instance, if you took Rochester, let's look at just Rochester, if it was a rain event, if it was, you know, wind or something like that, is there a tool that could model that?
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. There are some tools that can help. There are surprisingly large number of tools to help better understand what's happening in the face of a changing climate. I don't have one at the tips of my fingers. I would say that there are local governments that have begun doing what are called climate vulnerability analyses. And they're kind of, I've been working with the Climate Adaptation Partnership at the University of Minnesota. And my sense from working with, which is a university and local and state federal government collaboratives, a few private sector folks as well, there's a lot of good work happening and kind of more at the pilot level. I guess the reason I decided to come here today is I think we need to be looking more as a statewide level, given the severity and pace of climate change that's happening. So if you're interested in looking at some kind of local governments, climate vulnerability analyses is like the first step of this sort of more proactive climate adaptation planning that local governments or state governments can do.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm specifically wondering a quick tool with if you could plug in coordinates. If you are aware of a situation that you know is likely prone to be problematic, just to kind of check that out, test that out, look at that, where would your go-to stop be? What would your first location be?
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative.
And you can get back to me on that.
I'm going to have to get back to you. I just went to the Climate Adaptation Conference, and I have a page of about 12 tools. So I would like to look at which ones and see if there's one specifically, or one or two that might make most sense for the question you're asking. So I'd be happy to follow up or set up a meeting if that's helpful.
Thank you.
Any other questions, members? All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have one more person, Lane Selta. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. I probably am not. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Lane Sletta. I'm the Brown County Emergency Management Director. I've been working in emergency management for approximately 33 years. I want to say that I'm in favor of replenishing the disaster assistance contingency account. The need for this assistance to counties and townships and small cities is increasing as the number of disasters increase in severity in Minnesota. It is a fact that the severity of the storms are increasing. The number of presidential declarations we've had in Brown County is 14. And that's over since about 1965. We've had 10 presidential disasters declared since 2010. As you can see, things are getting worse as far as the emergency management end of things is concerned. I know the state has put money into the account, and it is vital that it is replenished since it is depleted. The small entities, the small units of government, you know, if there is a presidential disaster declared and they have to pay 25% of their disaster bill, that is going to be a big hit to their budget. The state contingency fund will cover that 25%, and it also covers disaster bills that are not to the threshold of a presidentially declared disaster. These disaster and response and recovery costs are a burden, and for a small township with not too many people in it, it doesn't take much for their entire operating budget to be blown out of the water. So this fund is really a godsend to the small units of government that have to deal with these disasters on a day-to-day basis. And these disasters really test the resilience of the smaller communities and smaller townships. So I would say that I can answer any questions that you may have concerning this.
Questions, members? Seeing none, thank you.
All right, thank you.
I will say that the County Emergency Manager Association was essential in the development of Chapter 12B, and we appreciate your help in developing that.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify? I also want to thank Representative Poppe. We did tap Representative Poppe's staff from the Ag and Food Committee for the development of the mini session, and it was her area of the state in 2007. I didn't know there was a Poppe farm until the flooding occurred, and we were going through Houston, which is almost flooded. So Representative Poppe is also a co-sponsor of the bill. There's no more discussion, members. Seeing that, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a quick word. We did have an amendment and decided not to offer it, but I think it brings up a discussion point of let's hope we don't have terrible disasters this spring, but in the situation where the $30 million may run out. And just concerned about looking down the road, trying to find a way, and I've discussed this with you too, of trying to keep this fund at a level sufficient for some kind of disaster without having to come back in special session, as you mentioned, or having these contingency plans if the budget is at a certain level. And I was just thinking, you know, we have over $1 billion in the budget reserve. We have a rainy day fund. If some of that could be designated, if the need were there, to replenish this disaster fund, to give it a more stable basis in case of a severe disaster someplace in the state. That's my concern.
Representative Anderson, thank you again for coming to the House floor. And we talked about your amendment last Thursday, and I appreciated that. We have been in discussion about what to do with this fund since really the mini session. and we were anticipating depletion of the fund just looking at what was coming at us. So we're in discussion with leadership right now as to how much should be put into this fund and whether or not there should be a permanent appropriation attached to it. Not a contingency appropriation, but a permanent appropriation and the size of that appropriation. So I will be in communication with you, too. I will tell you that I have exhausted my capacity for bill introductions. I'm up to 10 as of last week, and for me, that's a drunken sailor. Six of them deal just with this contingency account. So with the $10 million from last session, with what we were going to do to match with the session, that's exactly five too many bills for this account. So there's got to be a better way to fill this account and do it. So thank you. Representative Poppy also wanted to be recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to, again, thank Mr. Kelly and his staff. You know, they do just fabulous work. I represent an area that has been prone to flooding. So Austin has numerous times been declared federally to need funds, and it was, though, 2007 when the change happened with the Rushford flood, and I'm originally from Houston, so that's why I know Northland Lefse, and if you ever have the opportunity to go to Rushford and get great Lefse. So, but I would, you know, Mr. Cranbier, I very much appreciate the photos. I mean, for me, this just brings back the smell and the overall muck and that whole experience. And, you know, if you've never been through a flood, it's just an unbelievable all senses kind of experience. And it's very, very damaging, as Representative Sauk was talking about, with the emotional side of things. But, you know, in 2007 and in other times, we've had it's hit roads and bridges, and in that instance, hillsides that were had mudslides. I'd never seen that, you know, in that county to have literally just huge parts of the land just be sliding down the hill, and it impacts commerce and business and schools and individuals, families, social support networks. I mean, it's a flood can do such great damage so completely, and so I certainly support having funds that are available so that there is that opportunity to know that you've got something there immediately to take care of those first immediate needs, and then if there needs to be more, you know, beyond that, we work with that too, but definitely we've just seen too much of it throughout the state, and I'm glad that we're moving forward and that we'll have some funds available for people who are impacted so severely. Thank you.
Any further discussion, members? I'll renew my motion that House File 3633 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Meeting is adjourned.